Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, are the jobs we have the jobs we need? Economists believe that while millions of Americans are returning to work, even as the pandemic rages on, millions more have no job to go back to. Those jobs have vanished. As many as 11 million Americans lost a job, want a job, and still aren't working. But what if this virus-driven shock to our economy was also an opportunity to rewrite the social contract on what a good American job is? Harvard Business Review recently argued that too many companies offer bad jobs and that they get what they don't pay for. One of our guests today, MIT professor and Good Jobs Institute founder Zeynep Tan, writes, "This bad job system keeps customers underserved, deprives the company of a compelling value proposition, and prevents it from adapting to changing customer needs." She adds, combined with a weak balance sheet, these reasons drove many bankruptcies, including Borders, Toys R Us, Sears, and most recently Neiman Marcus, J. Crew, and JCPenney. So what does an economy that invests in good jobs look like? What would specific policy initiatives and legislation take to do that? And who would benefit? So two guests this hour and your experience. I'd like to know, if you have one of those jobs that doesn't pay well, it doesn't offer sick days or parental leave, what along with that would make it more equitable? How do you define what a good job is? Now, to some degree, that might be in the eye of the beholder, but I think we can all agree that there are some metrics or standards that define a good job. And I'd love to hear your input on that. How would you define what a good job is? And if you have one of those jobs that you don't think could be characterized as good, what would make it more equitable? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Zeynep Tan is with us, a professor in the Operations Management Group at MIT School of Management, and she is president of the nonprofit Good Jobs Institute, with us from Cambridge. And Zeynep, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
Rita Gunther McGrath is with us, an author and professor at Columbia Business School. She directs the Strategy in Times of Uncertainty program. Wow, what a good job at a time like this. Rita, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
A pleasure to be here.
I'm sure you've been busy with this. Zeynep, I think it's worth defining what a bad job is and whether there are some objective standards that we can apply to that. And then I want to know why so many Americans have those bad jobs. But how would you describe them?
Well, a bad job is one where you don't meet workers' basic needs. For example, the wages and benefits are so low that you're not able to take care of your family, you're not able to put food on the table. You have an unpredictable schedules, which makes it very hard for you to live a decent life. You have very few opportunities for growth and success. So your basic needs are not met and you are not treated with respect and dignity. And I see this over and over in so many different industries.
And so, Rita, let's talk about the industries. I think some of us might think, well, it's the retail sector, it's some of the blue-collar fields, but I think that might be too narrow of a perception of this. How would you describe it?
I would agree. It's endemic in our economy, and even in companies that are doing very well and are in very profitable sectors, you still see this prevalence of very bad, especially entry-level jobs. And not to pick on any one company, but J.P. Morgan Chase was recently called to account for basically not paying its tellers, you know, its customer service people, enough to provide for very basic needs for a very small family.
Jeez. Zainab, you went through, in that quote that I read from the Harvard Business Review, you went through companies like Neiman Marcus, J. Crew, Toys R Us, Sears, Borders. I mean, these are companies, especially, you know, some of these upscale Neiman Marcus, J. Crew, upscale companies that I think from the outside we'd say, well, they're pretty successful in their branding. What's going on inside the company with the quality of the jobs that they offer?
Yep. And Kerry, you just mentioned some retail examples. And retail is the largest employer in the United States, but it's hardly the only one that offers these types of bad jobs, either low-cost retail or high-end retail that you mentioned right now. Last year, 46.5 million Americans worked in occupations where the median wage was less than $15 an hour.
Wow.
And $15 an hour seems like a high enough amount, but when you think about a single parent taking care of their family with a, you know, with a child, that doesn't even cover their very basic expenses. So if you were in Minnesota, for example, working as a single parent, as a bank teller that Rita mentioned at JP Morgan Chase and making $15 an hour, if you worked 40 hours a week, you would be making $2,580 a month.
Yeah. Wow.
And that would fall $859 short of just rent, childcare, transportation, food, and medical expenses. And I'm not counting here like anything like personal care, clothing, leisure, cable, phone bills, housekeeping supplies, all these unexpected expenses that might come up. So this is the situation that we find ourselves in this economy.
Let me grab a call here from Rich in Coon Rapids. Hi, Rich. How do you define this?
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess, you know, what I was kind of thinking was that, you know, I guess good employment or a good job means that, you know, you could provide for a family, even if it's just, say, a basic measure, a family of four. And, you know, you certainly couldn't do that with the numbers you were talking about already. But I think, you know, the reflection may be the fact that, unfortunately, business or whatever you want to call it, big business, the business community, corporations have successfully divided and conquered labor in the United States, meaning that I think since, what, 1950 or 1960, there used to be 35% of the labor force unionized, and now there's, like, what, like 7%?
Yeah, this is a good point. Yeah.
And you combine that with the attachment or the fact that healthcare is attached to employment, which I don't think it should be, and I think most people are coming to that realization. You've got two unfortunate negatives on the side of labor and, you know, possible you know, leverage between union and business. So
okay, let me take that back to the guests. It's a good point. Rita, where does this intersect with what Rich has described as the diminishing influence of unions?
Well, it's huge. It's huge. The post-war consensus among business leaders, and I think it's really important to understand the context, was they looked at tens and tens of millions of workers coming back from World War II with nothing to do. And the prospect of social unrest and the devastation that would cause was sufficiently vivid in their minds that a group called the Committee for Economic Development got together. And these were leading business leaders. And they said, you know, one of our primary goals is to create good jobs. And the policies they put in place essentially created the post-war American middle class, which is widely seen as a historical and unique success story.
Just a little context there. 63, I was looking at some of the statistics from the Census Bureau. 63% of the jobs created in the U.S. private sector since 1990, low-wage, low-hours work. And if you adjust for inflation, people who are making $54,000 a year now are making less than they were in 1988. Zeynep, I mean, we are losing ground in so many of these jobs. That number, 63%, just floors me.
Oh, that is a very sad statistic. And what is even worse is that when you look at where the new job growth is coming from, the top 20 highest growth jobs are mostly in low-wage sectors, which don't require education or a college education. So if we want to create a healthy middle class, we need to find a way to transform these bad jobs with low wages, unpredictable schedules, few opportunities for growth and success mm-hmm. into good jobs. There's no other way around it.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, with two guests who think about the quality of good jobs a lot, and we've asked them to join the discussion this morning. We're asking, what if the shock to the economy that has occurred during this pandemic and an economic recession was also an opportunity to rewrite this social contract on what a good American job is? How would we go about that? We're going to talk with our guests about it. Why are so many of the jobs that have been created, and we've just heard Zeynep Tun tell us many of the jobs that are going to be needed, why are they so low income, sometimes low hours? Why are those the jobs that are in demand? How do we turn that around? I want to know how you would characterize what a good job is. And whether you have one of those jobs that we're talking about that doesn't pay well, it doesn't offer sick days, it doesn't offer parental leave, what would make the job and the work and the field that you're in more equitable? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieNPR, Naomi says, work-life balance, accruing paid time off, health insurance, you actually look forward to going into work, Naomi's given this a lot of thought, and leadership that cares about you, especially your voice. To the phones to Joel in Duluth. Hi, Joel.
Yes, I have a comment is that if we're going to look at better quality jobs, what we need to do is look at the education factor that companies can use to advance that person beyond an entry-level job. Then we also need to look at an example of unions that have gone bad as the police union and the teachers union for insufficient requirements and protecting employees so that employees need to excel in work also.
Okay.
But I think if we focus on the idea that education factor to promote them so that they move out of the entry-level jobs would be a way to improve the situation.
Super interesting. So companies investing in advancement within the companies. Rita, what do we see with that, with most companies?
Well, so here's the bigger context, I think, for that. And William Lozanek, who's an economist at the University of Massachusetts, has pointed this out. He said, America went from a retain and reinvest economy, where your presumption was people would be with you for the long term, and you would invest in R&D, and you would invest in their wages, and in return, they would give you their best efforts, their creativity, their human ingenuity, and all that. And it worked really, really well up until, I'd say, the late 70s. So if you took a typical firm in 1970, 50% of their profits went to wages and R&D. And mm-hmm. if you took the same kind of firm in 2015, 9% of their wages went to wages and R&D.
Wow.
So, you know, what's basically happened is we've seen just an enormous amount of what Lozanek unabashedly calls predatory value extraction, where we've tilted our economy to executives and shareholders and basically left everybody else behind.
So just so I'm perfectly clear on this, the more and more, a bigger and bigger share of the profits are going to the top, what percentage is it, executive echelon in the company?
Yes. Well, the top executives who are often compensated in stock, and things like share buybacks, which cause the price of stock to go up, and essentially it's stock price manipulation, and it's perfectly legal. But you have those kinds of practices, which nobody's really called them out. And, you know, honestly, the typical person looking for a job does not wake up in the morning in a panic about, oh, my God, stock buybacks.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those more obscure issues, but it's part of the whole fabric, which has resulted in that those numbers that I related, which is more and more of the profits going to fewer and fewer of the participants in any company's situation.
And Zeynep, this is happening even as productivity within these companies is increasing, right? So the fruits of that increased productivity are not being shared down the line. They're being grabbed more and more by the people at the top. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, there is that amazing productivity disconnect, productivity and wage growth disconnect that economists talk about that started happening in 1970s. And part of that came from, you know, the weakening of the worker voice, as we talked about. Part of it came from technology adoption, automation, and part of it came from some of the manufacturing jobs to be offshore to other countries. So there are lots of drivers of this productivity decoupling from the wage growth that we see in the economy. But as you said, this is the time. There is a tremendous opportunity to change things and rewrite the social contract. I mean, Rita talked about World War II mm-hmm. and how business leaders during World War II completely wrote a social contract, and they said, we want to create more jobs and we want to create better jobs. And part of what drove them was their fear of socialism and their fear of communism. And I think the stakes for capitalism are similar now. I mean, I teach at a business school, Rita teaches at a business school, and my students tend to believe that capitalism doesn't just drive inequality, which is, you know, expected. It's the future of capitalism. We celebrate some inequality, mm-hmm. but they believe it also drives injustice. And that's not right.
So you're saying change is coming with this generation of business students and business leaders? Yes.
I think there's a lot more demand from our business school students for companies that treat people with respect and dignity, for companies to take better care of the environment and to have a higher purpose. I see that for sure in my classroom.
Call here from Margaret in Minneapolis. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, I'm a millennial, uh-huh. and this conversation definitely reflects what a lot of people in my generation are experiencing. You know, a lot of us having gone through college and strapped with, you know, a lot of student debt as
right,
well.
Right.
You know, my personal experience, I worked in retail and these lower paying jobs, you know, in college and freshly out of college, which is maybe kind of typical. But I ended up going into the nonprofit sector, which kind of speaks to the, you know, value focused interests of my generation.
Right.
And, you know, the nonprofit sector is another really problematic piece in this puzzle. It's probably not as big of a piece of the economic sector as the retail and manufacturing that you're talking about. But I know so many people I know are so interested in working and having work with meaning, but we're working in the nonprofit sector that just doesn't pay. Like, I didn't have benefits. I didn't have health care. I was working for, which is quote unquote,
Margaret,
there's just no way.
Yeah, your phone dropped there. Would you just say what the very end of what you were saying?
Yeah, just that we're working for, I wanted to have a family at some point. And so I had to leave the nonprofit sector, and I now have a decent paying job. But it's just something that so many people in my generation, they want to have this value-based work.
Right.
But the nonprofit sector just doesn't support people being able to, like, have a family or, you know, have decent health care or, you know, do anything like that, which is just so ironic given that so many people are going into that sector, you know, based on their desire to, you know, change the world.
Yeah. And you're the second listener who has brought up health care. So I think I had a talk with Zeynep and Rita about this. Rita, it is the case that as health care costs rose, companies squeezed employees' wages to make up for those increased costs. It seems like Americans on kind of both sides of this are doing more cost sharing on healthcare. We are paying more of the, you know, point of care costs, but we're also, it seems, sacrificing some wage growth because of increased healthcare costs. Would you give me some context on that?
Sure. So part of what you're seeing in the healthcare conundrum is essentially companies socializing their healthcare costs. In other words, they're externalizing their healthcare responsibilities to basically to us, to the public. And that shows up in emergency room utilization. It shows up in people not getting the care that they need early, so they show up with much more severe cases later on. And there was a really interesting natural experiment conducted by the city of San Francisco some years ago. And they had a very activist mayor and council who said, this is ridiculous. And so companies, if you want to be in San Francisco, you can pay for your healthcare costs in three ways. You can offer your employees decent coverage. You can pay us a tax that we will offer your employees in decent coverage. Or, you know, you can come up with some creative way of making sure that they're getting health care. And, of course, everybody went crazy in the business community. Oh, my God, this is socialism. This is terrible. This is going to be awful. And, you know, San Francisco is doing just fine. People are getting care that never got care before. Hospital emergency room utilization rates went way down. Companies reported higher productivity.
Really?
Workers didn't come to work sick. I mean, it was such an interesting natural experiment. My colleague Jeffrey Seffer at Stanford writes about this in a very famous book called Dying for a Paycheck, and in which he basically says, you know, a lot of what we get told about things companies can and can't afford is just not true, and that your low wage, low hour predictability, poor jobs does not equate to low labor costs. And as Zainab's research shows, you know, we're dealing with incredibly high rates of churn, turnover, disengagement, people showing up to work sick. I mean, it's not good for anybody. And I think it's just one last thought is, you know, Dan Price of Gravity Payments, very famously some years back, offered all of his employees a $70,000 minimum wage. And, of course, everybody in the business community would think this was going to be this was going to bankrupt the company, of course. And it didn't. Their sales have taken off. They're doing really well. People are having babies. They're, you know, getting their health care seen. They're coming to work. They're loyal. I mean, he's got applications for jobs at his company that rival those of applications for the MBA at Harvard Business School.
Wow. Huh. Zainab, what would you add to that from your research? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, bad jobs are a lose-lose for workers and for companies, and of course, it's a lose for our society. I mean, in my work earlier, the first decade of my research, I found how expensive bad jobs were for companies. Not just high employee turnover costs, which are, you know, quite expensive, but bad jobs led to lots of operational problems, customer service problems that then reduced company sales and profits, which then, of course, reduced their labor budgets, which then drove even worse jobs. So companies that offer bad jobs work in a vicious cycle, and that vicious cycle is bad for workers, it's bad for companies, and it's even bad for customers. So it is a lose-lose-lose, and this shows that bad jobs are a choice that companies are making. It's not because in their industry they can't afford to pay higher wages and better benefits and better jobs to their workers. And it's not because it has to come at the expense of low prices. They are a choice that companies are making, and we need to encourage more companies to make the choice to offer good jobs. And there are some examples, like Costco is one of my favorite examples. Hmm. The average Costco hourly worker makes a little bit more than $23 an hour,
wow,
which is double the rate. Yeah. And one of your callers talked about education and advancement. Well, if you work at Costco, you don't have a job. You have a career, because 100% or nearly 100% of the managers are promoted from within. So when you're hired, you know that you can be that meat manager. You can be that department manager. You can be that warehouse manager, which is a quite high-paying job. So there are examples of companies that are providing their employees, just their customers, just as low prices, and their employees good jobs, and their shareholders fantastic returns. And we need to encourage more companies to choose that strategy, because it is profitable and it is doable.
Matthew called. He's an over-the-road trucker. He was near Rochester when he called. He says, most of us work by the mile. And if we aren't moving, we aren't being paid, we don't make enough to support a family. I'd love to know about the field you're in and the work you do and whether you would define the work you do as a good job. You've heard us now developing this conversation this morning about kind of what the standards, what the metrics of a good job are, why it is not to the company's disadvantage to pay workers more, why we've ended up with so many low hours and low paid jobs in America. And now on the other side of the latest news here, we're going to talk about what specific policies would make a difference. How do we get more American workers into good jobs? So tell me a little bit about the field you're in, the work you do, whether you define the job you have as a good job, and what do you think would make it more equitable? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Our guest this hour for the conversation, Rita Gunther McGrath, is with us. She's an author and professor at Columbia Business School, and she directs the Strategy in Times of Uncertainty program. And Zeynep Tun is with us. She's a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, and she is president of the nonprofit Good Jobs Institute. I'm going right back to the phones to Karen in Minneapolis. So, Karen, what do you want to add to this discussion?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that we are determining, or the pay is determined by skill level versus just the importance of a job to the success of a company or even of the functioning of society, which we've been able to see in this COVID thing. And, you know, some people do not have the cognitive ability or the social skills to succeed in a job that's going to require more education. Maybe the best they can do is push grocery carts back to the store. If you do that every day for 40 hours a week out in the wintertime, I feel like you should be able to make a living wage doing that. The grocery store certainly can't function without somebody doing that work.
Zeynep, what would you say about this, what Karen's suggesting about the way we value skills and the way we see certain jobs?
Karen, I loved what you said. And during COVID-19, during the pandemic, we called grocery workers, meat packers, essential workers. But you wouldn't know that they are essential if you just looked at their wages. A meat packer makes $14 an hour, not enough to be able to have a living. And I oftentimes, when I think about the worth of a job, I go back to Martin Luther King when he was at a Memphis church. This was one of his last speeches in 1968, and he was addressing sanitation workers who were on strike, and their job is also worth. And he said, so often we overlook the work and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight that wherever you engage in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth. I think it is time that we understand the worth of meaning and dignity of all jobs and enable people working at a store, taking care of our elderly, to be able to make a living wage with the jobs that we have.
So, Rita, I want to ask you then, you both have given us examples of change at the top of companies, right? CEOs that decide this is how this company is going to be run. You gave us an example of San Francisco coming in to say, you know, this is how it's going to be if you want to have a company in San Francisco. What are some of the other policies that would make a big difference and are doable if you don't run a company, but you can, you know, you can be an activist for?
Sure. So there's a litany of real basic ones. So the first thing we could do is reverse a 1982 SEC ruling that basically made this unfettered ability to buy back stock, you know, legal. Before that, it was considered illegal stock price manipulation. And that would, I mean, it's not going to solve things, but it would at least remove one easy tool that companies are that leaders are using to extract value from companies.
Okay.
Secondly, definitely restoring teeth to labor. You know, one of the big, I think, issues that we've seen with the rise of tech and the rise of those kinds of companies is they've been very forthcoming coming about not wanting organizing and not allowing workers to communicate. And I think it's amazing there's not more outcry about, you know, well-regarded tech companies, and you know who they are, being so adversarial with respect to their workforce, when in fact they are nothing if not their workforce. So I think a previous caller said increasing the ability of labor to advocate for people. And, you know, one of the most popular, although least talked about, simple proposals is to do what Germany does and have workers on the board. And believe me, if you've got a worker on your board, you're going to be taking worker concerns to heart a lot more than if you don't.
That seems, you know, that last one, I wasn't aware that that was a rule in Germany. How would that actually come to pass? These were companies, individual companies that would have to permit this, or would this be some kind
of
legislation?
Law. Germany, it's a law. Huh. You have to consult with workers' councils. They have a seat on the board. I think it's at least two board seats are reserved for workers. And when you are making a big decision as a large organization in Germany, you have to take those voices into account. And so, you know, right now, workers have no power, no negotiation ability. I mean, there are companies who are, out of the goodness of their hearts, taking workers' concerns into account. But, you know, in a capitalist system, leaving things like that to the goodness of individual people's hearts is a pretty risky proposition.
Yeah, I mean, Zainab, we see what happens when the employees at Amazon rally and put public pressure on Jeff Bezos, or what's happening at Facebook with the advertiser boycotts. But do you agree with Rita that that's not the way a capitalist society should be allowed to work?
Yeah, I mean, we should have certain rules in our capitalist society so that the game is fair for everyone to play. And a few of the other things that I would add to this list from a policy perspective is, and one which is just information, more information, I would encourage companies to disclose their annual take-home pay information. As you talked about bad jobs, you kept saying low pay and low hours. And the hours is so important because so few people get 40 hours a week every week. So if we encourage companies to do an analysis of their annual take-home pay and disclose that by race and by gender, we would move mountains, I think. At our nonprofit Good Jobs Institute, we work with companies, we do workshops with large companies, and when we do this living wage analysis for them, we put the histogram of the wages of all their frontline employees, and when executives see how few of them make a living wage, they're oftentimes shocked.
Really?
And as much as we like to, yes, because they have not looked at those data before. It takes us a while to be able to collect those data and show it to them. And I will also say most executives, they don't get out of bed and say, how can I offer bad jobs today?
Yeah.
I mean, most of them are very nice people and they want to do the right thing, but they feel like they can't because they're trapped in a system and they don't really have the incentives because of what Rita mentioned, their compensation is tied to the short-term value of the firm. But if you make these data apparent to them, I remember several years ago when Mark Bartoloni, who was then the CEO of Aetna, when they conducted this analysis and when he found out how few of his employees made a living wage, those who work at the call centers, and how many of them relied on government benefits, he said, it's just not right for a Fortune 100 company to have people who rely on government benefits. Mm-hmm. And he changed the minimum wage from $12 an hour to $16 an hour. So,
and but he had to see the numbers, the undeniable gap, right?
He had to see the numbers and be struck with it. And if we had companies disclosing those data, then customers would see those numbers. Then investors would see then those numbers. Then there would be a conversation around those numbers. And maybe some industries will take steps to improve those numbers. Because in absence of those, when we discuss bad jobs, what are we talking about? So I think one of the top things in my list would be to encourage companies to disclose their pay data and do it by race and gender, because we know that, you know, Black workers make something like $78 on the hour, 78 cents on the dollar compared to white workers.
Let me grab another call here from, and by the way, if you're trying to get in on the phone lines, pretty busy. Keep trying, though. I'd like to hear from you. We'll hear from a number of listeners now. To Joe in Grand Rapids. Hi, Joe. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. When I'm thinking about good jobs, I'm a heavy equipment operator with Local 49.
Yep.
And we are an industry in labor that I think is really misconceived by the general public what labor is. And people think of it as usually, you know, ditch diggers or the bottom of the barrel, the guys that do the hard work. But these are extremely high-paying jobs in high demand.
Mm-hmm.
And education falls right hand in hand with it because our apprenticeship programs through all the trades is training while you get paid. So you're not accruing any of that student debt while you learn.
Yeah. Good point. Joe, I'm really glad you called with this. Rita, you were talking about how Germany does things earlier. Isn't this something that Germany does with the apprenticeship programs?
Yes. So one of the things that America's gotten itself into that I think is a big mistake is this idea that everybody's got to have academic credentials to get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And what in the German system, what they do is there's a series of screens, and those that indeed want to get and need to get an academic position go to university, and those that don't, who may be equally intelligent and equally gifted, but that's just not their thing, they have the opportunity to go into paid apprenticeship programs. And, you know, that has... And if you think about the German economy, it's the engine powerhouse of Europe, and there's this concerted partnership between labor and management, which has helped put it there. And so the apprenticeship program is a big backbone of what they call the Mittelstand, which is the medium-sized German companies that are so much of the engine of their economy.
Now, when I've heard criticism of that, I've heard people say, you get boxed in. I mean, the beauty of this this system that we have here is you can get an education and qualify yourself for something else, and you haven't, you know, from the time you were 14, decided that this is the track you're on. Is that at all true?
Yeah, sure. There's some truth to it, but not for the vast majority. I mean, what most people don't realize is 80% of the Americans that start a college education don't get a credential. You know, we always think of it as 18 to 22-year-olds who show up at graduation day. What you've got is the worst of both worlds. You've got 80% of people who have typically incurred student debt, which, by the way, you don't have as much of in the German context because universities are heavily publicly subsidized. So they're in the worst shape. They've got student debt and no degree. And so you're boxed out as effectively as anything. And so if you ask a lot of those people, would they like an apprenticeship program that was a glide path to the kind of job our caller was just describing? I think you'd have a rather different perspective.
Yes, yeah. That makes sense. A little context here, since we're talking about younger Americans and younger workers, Brookings says that 53 million Americans, 18 to 64, make a median wage of $10.22 an hour. So it's a lot of people who are in prime working years, and they're making around $18,000 a year. That's a lot of younger workers and workers in their prime and older workers who are not making more than about $10.25 an hour. Phone call here from Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. I just kind of wanted to remark about my own personal experience in the working world. I spent about 16 years working in retail, and really the only way to gain any sort of promotion, be it in terms of responsibility or obviously an increase in wage, was really to move laterally from other organizations to other companies and things like that. About 4 years ago, I decided that I was kind of done with that world and wanted to make a career change, so I went back to school full-time.
Mm-hmm.
And roughly around that same time as two, I made the leap into the IT sector, which is what my education was in. And my very first IT job, I was an IT contractor for a major Minnesota company and making only about $12 an hour.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Which was, you know, that was roughly a 40 to 50% pay cut from what I had achieved and from the management level in retail to go down to do that.
Yeah.
Now, I've since left that job about a year ago and managed to actually about triple my income from that first IT job. But, you know, not everybody is as lucky and blessed to be able to take a 40 to 50% pay cut. You know, my spouse and I were able to obviously make ends meet for the period of about 2 years while I gained those those skills that allowed me to kind of move into my new job role. But, you know, that can be obviously a pretty big barrier for people to be able to go back to school or to retrain in some capacity to be able to, you know, kind of make a move to something that obviously is going to pay them significantly better.
It's but, a really, yeah, Chris, if I might, it's a really good point. And I think it goes back to something, Zeynep, that you were talking about, which is the spectrum of pay within a company and how many people at the other end of that spectrum are making, again, living wages that are making wages that they cannot live on compared to, you know, what the upper executive echelon is making.
Yes, and it is completely possible to lift up the bottom part of the economy. Mm-hmm. Chris mentioned the retail jobs. There's no reason why a retail job could not become a good job. I gave Costco as an example before. And you know, one of the things, when we look at the low-wage sectors, we tend to equate low-wage with low-skill, but that's not necessarily the case. Just because a job pays low wages, like the IT contractor, it's not a low-skilled job. You need to know lots of things. I work with a supermarket chain where the, you know, deli manager, they need to know so much about the different types of cuts and how to order merchandise, how to serve the customers. So let's not confuse low wage with low skills, but it's completely possible to make these jobs, the existing jobs that we have, to be good jobs.
Rita, the prevailing wisdom about what's going on with the economy right now seems to be companies are just holding tight and trying to survive this. I think I hear you both saying this is also an opportunity to reassess the way that you pay and how you see your workforce. But it also seems like, I mean, you direct the Strategy in Times of Uncertainty program. You know, you can see companies just saying, it's so uncertain, I'm not going to do anything that's the least bit different or risky. So what would your answer be to that?
Well, I think that's the most risky situation of all. Because, you like it or not, the rules are being rewritten even as we speak here. So a couple of thoughts on that. I think what we are seeing is kind of a Y shape in the economy where mm-hmm. certain sectors, so clearly hospitality, travel, you know, large-scale sports, you know, anything that relies on people being comfortable with close physical contact with strangers, they're reeling. They're really, you know, suffering. The other part of the economy is crushing it. I mean, they're doing really well. And what I think one of the scenarios that I've outlined in some of my recent work is what I call a repeat of the Rendezvous with Destiny. And a lot of people have forgotten this, but back in the dark days of the Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a patrician, I mean, he came from the moneyed yes. classes, basically said, we are no longer going to have the tyranny of capital being owned by a small number of capitalists. And so, you know, trust busting, the original rules around labor, the creation of many of our social safety net programs all came from that era. And the way I would characterize that is a Rendezvous with Destiny kind of moment. And I think with corporate leaders, what I try to explain to them is, you know, these forces are beyond your individual control. And if we as a society have a widespread perception that this is not right for the vast majority of people, you're going to unleash forces that you can't even anticipate right now. Mm. And so you're better off thinking about and getting ahead of it than just sitting there frozen and letting it wash over you.
You know, this description of a Y-shaped economy really makes sense. Draw a Y and you see us at the, you know, at the bottom, on the bottom end of that, and then you see the branches, and you're saying one branch, these are the jobs that have just powered on, right, with no real change, people who can work from home. The other side of is you, nothing is the same as it was at the moment before the pandemic.
Well, could I add one more data point that I think is really important, which is a McDonald's worker, an ordinary person that flips hamburgers in McDonald's, makes the equivalent to $20 an hour, mm-hmm. has guaranteed health care, has access to you know, fairly inexpensive higher education, and generous subsidies towards public housing. So the basic needs of humanity, you know, education, housing, health care, you know, basic human needs. They're met, and these people are making enough money that they can put a little money in their savings accounts and, you know, maybe even afford a family vacation. And this is somebody on the front lines at McDonald's, so don't tell me it can't be done. They can manage it in Denmark. Why can't they manage it here?
Call here from Rose in Minneapolis. Hi, Rose. You're here to talk to us about small businesses. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, it sounds like most of the conversation is about larger corporations,
yeah,
but I'm wondering what can small businesses do to provide better jobs or to improve the jobs that they're providing, you know, like a business that has 5 to 10 workers and maybe, I don't know, is kind of stuck with how to improve those jobs. Is there anything that the guests could suggest?
Yeah, Rose, do you run a small company or work for a small company?
I work for one,
okay.
But I do have somewhat input into
good
how the company works.
Good. This is a really good question, Zeynep. What kind of advice would you give on this?
Yeah, I think for a small business, first on the strategic part, to make sure where you play is profitable. I think small businesses can thrive by creating a much more compelling experience for their customers, be it business customers or direct to consumers. So I think making sure that you have a value proposition around a differentiated product or service is really important for small businesses. And that differentiated product and service is hard to do without taking care of employees, without ensuring that, you know, they know about the products and services that you offer and they can serve your customers so well. So I think I will start at the strategy level for the small to small, medium-sized businesses.
I want to grab one last call here from James in Woodbury. Hi, James. You're also a truck driver, it sounds like.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So tell me what you wanted to add to this.
Yeah. So what I wanted to add was regarding the compensation for workers and stuff. You know, I was listening to the station just prior how there were some people that were, you know, talking about, you know, low-paying wages. Well, yeah, at the end of the day, there are going to be businesses. There's plenty of them out there that are going to basically stiff their employees because that's just how greedy they are.
Yep.
You know, that's how the world works now. It's everyone's about money. And like Joe said earlier, he's a heavy equipment operator.
Right.
You know, there's lots of jobs right now that does not require a college education where you can make on average $70,000, $80,000 a year. You know, and they're willing to pay you to get trained while you do it. You know, that's basically, you know, for example, I'm only 22 years old. I didn't go to school, you know, and I'm going to make more than something. Plenty of my friends that all went to school, not just that. You know, they're the same age as me, and they have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 of student debt to still pay when they're only making $60,000
wow
a year. Like, how is that going to work?
So
the work's out there. If you want hours, you want the money, you want the work, you want a good job, solid job that's not going to go anywhere. You know,
yeah, James.
You know, working in the labor, you know, industry, you know, doing whatever that may be, that's there. You know,
James, I'm just a little bit tight on time. I didn't want to interrupt you, but Rita, I think this goes back to what you were saying earlier about how we need to change the way we think about what is required, how we define a good job, and where education fits in. Yes,
absolutely.
Would you just say a little bit more on that?
Sure. I think what we're moving towards is micro credentials. So we're not all insisting on BAs for every job, which is basically laziness on the part of recruiters, and breaking education up into smaller, more actionable pieces. And I think that'll meet the needs of employers and employees much better.
That is super interesting, Michael. Micro-credentials. We may have to talk about that again. Rita, thank you so much for the time. Really great to have you this morning.
A pleasure to be here.
Zeynep, thank you. Really good to have you this morning. Thanks for the work and the research, too, from both of our guests.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Zeynep Tan with us. She's the president of the nonprofit Good Jobs Institute and a professor at MIT. And Rita Gunther-McGrath with us. She's a professor at Columbia Business School, and she directs the Strategy in Times of Uncertainty program. You can find it if you missed much of the show. You can find it on the podcast as soon as we turn the audio around this afternoon.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.